We continue this Lent by listening to and learning from the stories of the Passion of Jesus from the chapters 26 and 27 of the Gospel of Matthew. Today's passage lies somewhere between Isaiah 55, "Seek the Lord while he can be found," and Psalm 13, "Where is God?" Listen to these familiar words from chapter 26, beginning at verse 36. Then Jesus went with the disciples to a place called Gethsemane, and he said to his disciples, "Sit here while I go over there and pray." He took with him Peter and the two sons of Zebedee and began to be grieved and agitated. Then he said to them, "I am deeply grieved even to death. Remain here and stay awake with me." And going a little farther, he threw himself on the ground and prayed, "My Father, if it is possible, let this cup pass from me. Yet not what I want, but what you want." Then he came to the disciples and found them sleeping. And he said to Peter, "So could you not stay awake with me 1 hour? Stay awake and pray that you may not come into the time of trial. My spirit indeed is willing, but this flesh is weak." Again he went away for the second time and prayed, "My Father, if this cannot pass unless I drink it, your will be done." Again Jesus came and found them sleeping, for their eyes were heavy. So leaving them again, he went away and prayed for the third time, saying the same words. Then he came to the disciples and said to them, "Are you still sleeping and taking your rest? See, the hour is at hand, and the Son of Man is betrayed into the hands of sinners. Get up, let us be going. See, my betrayer is at hand." This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. It's a scene that is often portrayed in stained glass. Jesus is in the center, kneeling with his hands clasped and his eyes looking toward heaven. Around him and in the foreground, three disciples lying flat on the ground. They are fast asleep with their heads cradled in their arms. It's hard to avoid talking about those disciples. Peter, James, and John are the three closest friends of Jesus. He has taken them everywhere. He has told them everything. How could they possibly fall asleep on him? Sure, the hour is late. They have just polished off a four-course Passover meal. Their full bellies are probably talking to their eyelids. And not only that, all of them are in danger, and they know it. It's a natural human response to sleep when we are afraid. We just want to shut everything out, close our eyes, and pretend it isn't there. And if we could, we'd take a snooze and hope that everything is a bad dream. And I think such is the situation of Peter, James, and John. But let's not be distracted by the three of them, for this is a story primarily about Jesus. He is heartsick, sad, and sorrowful. Matthew describes the Lord's emotions with the same words he has just used to describe the mood of the disciples at the Last Supper. When Jesus says, "One of you will betray me," he says they were thrown into sorrow and they were heavy with grief. It's the same word. When the Lord told him the truth, he was clear and strong. But now it is his turn to face what is coming. Not to do so openly for the crowds to see, not with histrionics or blubbering to call attention to himself. No, this is an honest man facing what lies ahead. It is a profound moment, heavy. It's very heavy. Have you been present for a moment like that? I think of my own father. He was a strong man, not prone to emotional drama. He was rational and scientific to a fault, thoroughly in charge of his entire dominion. Yet I was there the afternoon he was diagnosed with a fatal disease, and he broke down and sobbed inconsolably. It was the only time I ever heard my father cry. It was heavy, really heavy. Jesus is facing his own death. He knows it is coming. He has a good idea how. He's pretty sure it will begin with another friend turning him in. His hands will be tied behind his back. They'll make fun of him, poke him, do whatever they can to humiliate him. And that's just the beginning. No doubt, he has a fertile imagination shaped by the cruelty that the empire wields every day. He knows the hammer and the nails are coming. So he falls to his knees to pray, "Let this cup pass. Oh, Father, let this cup pass." This is one of the implications of the incarnation, of God choosing to come to us as a human being. Jesus sets aside the power to create the stars and move the planets in their courses. He came down and took on the limitations of being a person like any of us, a fragile, time-bound person. It's recognition that we don't call all the shots on our lives. There's so much that we cannot control, and Jesus takes on the same when he pulls on human skin. And this is a great mystery. He worked miracles for others, but he did not and would not work a miracle for himself. He healed the sick everywhere else, but in Gethsemane, his own soul is now sick. He could shout at a storm in Galilee and say with all authority, "Hush up," and the wind and the waves would obey him. But now another storm forms around him and within him, and he is powerless to stop it. So he prays a second time, "Father, let this cup pass." Jesus knows his destiny. He's already had that conversation of sorts with Simon Peter. He told Peter, "I must go to Jerusalem and be killed." And Peter shouted, "No, not you, never you, certainly not you, the powerful Messiah." Jesus stared him down, called out the devil in him, and said, "Peter, you are embracing human values, not heavenly ones. For what greater human value could there be than saving your own skin?" The human inclination, the first inclination, is to think only of yourself. So we hear reports of people hoarding all the toilet paper as if they're all going to use it, or stockpiling all the cleaning supplies, or worst, never taking responsibility for one's own self-centered neglect. Yet Jesus knows he must go to Jerusalem. He must. And in Jerusalem, he will be called upon to make the ultimate sacrifice, to drink the cup of suffering, to serve the whole world by giving his life as a ransom for many. This is what he must do. So he prays a third time, "My Father, if it is possible, let this cup pass from me, yet not what I want, but what you want." I hope we can hear the conflict in his words, for it is real. Jesus is not repeating this prayer three times for our benefit. He's not saying it for Simon Peter to wake from his slumber, write it down, and then give it to Matthew, the gospel writer, later on. No, Jesus is facing a sincere dilemma. One way to frame it might sound like this. Father, I know what you want, and I know what I want. Could you give me what I want, and let that be what you want? Now, we all would hope for that kind of outcome. Like this prayer, for instance. Father, don't let me get sick, for I know your will for us is good health. Or this. Father, flood my tears with your overwhelming joy, for your will is to send light into darkness. Or how about this? Father, do not let me ever become self-centered and isolated, for your will is to create compassion and human community. But do we ever hear anybody praying like that? More often, we hear the very different prayers, like, Holy God, give me what I want, as if we're commanding the supreme ruler of the universe to do an act of magic. Or the ridiculous prayer of the television evangelist, Oh Lord, give me a private jet funded by the suckers who throw their money into the offering plate. Or my favorite of all, Shel Silverstein's prayer of the selfish child. It goes like this. Now I lay me down to sleep, I pray the Lord my soul to keep, and if I die before I wake, I pray the Lord my toys to break, so none of the other kids can use them. How different these prayers are from the prayer of Jesus in Gethsemane. He asks for deliverance, but not out of greed. He sets his wishes within the greater intentions of God and says, Nevertheless, not my will, but yours be done. Prayer, true prayer, is kneeling before the God who is bigger, holier, wiser, and far more just than we are. Now listen, I know there are those other verses, and you know the ones. Jesus says, ask whatever you wish, and the Father will give it to you. He does say that. So somebody will pray, Lord, I need a set of new luggage, or Lord, I want a new boyfriend, or Lord, I want you to keep me well, even if everybody else gets sick. The point is, if we're praying apart from pursuing the will of God, we are putting ourselves in spiritual danger. As it is, we are already infected by the American myth that everything will always turn out well, that life will always land on the bright side, that we will be blessed in ways that others will not. That kind of thinking leads to a false privilege, inclines us toward overconsumption, and worst of all, it is the self-centered seabed for human destruction. So how does Jesus pray? How does Jesus teach us to pray? With four words, Thy will be done. Let God's will be done on earth, because it is surely done around the throne of heaven. Let life on earth be shaped to resemble the life that already is in heaven. And if there be any question about this, Jesus already teaches the will of God for heaven and on earth. That the broken be mended, that those who mourn will be comforted, that mercy will be met with mercy, that those hungry and thirsty for righteousness will taste it, that the meek will inherit the world God created for them, that the peacemakers and the healers would be adopted as God's own kin, that the hungry would be fed and the naked clothed and the prisoners visited rather than abandoned, and that the wretched of the earth would be treated as God's own royalty. And then there's one thing more. that all sin would be canceled and forgiven, and all those disrupted by sin would be set free from all the damage. That is the will of God. And that is what is embodied in Jesus, who goes to Jerusalem to pay the ransom and to set free all who can live in that freedom. Today we overhear the prayer of Jesus in his moment of extremity. O Father, if it is possible, let this cup pass from me. Nevertheless, not what I want, but what you want. If we have heard the gospel, we have heard what God wants. And ultimately, sooner or later, one way or another, this is what God will achieve, for God always wins. The miracle is that we can be part of this heavenly intention for earth, mending, comforting, showing mercy, tasting righteousness, and all the rest. We can choose it by choosing the will of God over our own will, and we can live it first by praying it. You know, a lot of people talk about having a personal relationship with God. Let me tell it to you straight, that personal relationship is a life of prayer. Spoken prayer, silent prayer, still prayer, and never forget it, active prayer. It's the kind of prayer like Jesus that acknowledges what is on our hearts, but above all pursues the will of God and submits to it when it is discerned. It is the prayer that always asks, Lord, what is it that you want for the world and how can I be part of that? If we ask these words, truly ask, the promise is that that prayer will always be answered. Just last month, some of our church folks met every week to learn about Howard Thurman. He was a wise teacher from the last generation, and he knew God face to face. At one point, Thurman said something very deep. That true prayer has very little to do with bringing something external to pass. Rather, it has to do with the relationship between God and those who pray. Here's what he said. The essence of prayer is that God answers the prayer, the one praying. And that, he said, is far more important than answering 1,000 prayers. And God's answer, he said, is this. I see you. I love you. I am with you. No matter what. In the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit.